a reading, and then we'll have lots of time for you to ask Grant some questions. The only thing I want to say about Grant's method is, well, we sort of talked about what I should say about Grant. I want to say is that writing a book is really hard work, and it takes literally, in this case, blood, sweat and tears. This book has been, I think, 7 years in the making, but far, far longer. The story has been absolutely lived, it has been worked, and there's been a lot of tears, I think. There's been probably literally some blood and an awful lot of sweat in the making of this book. It's a great book, and I hope you'll take the chance to buy a copy and read it. Tonight, we are offering, or Blackwell's have very kindly said they'll offer two copies for £20. It's £12.99, but tonight only you can get two if you want to give one to a friend. I'm going to also introduce Faith Brennan. She's a local businesswoman, and she also has done some charity work. She's been developing charities in Ghana, so she knows a little bit about how hard it is. So please, will you join me in welcoming Faith Brennan and Grant Smith?
All righty, good evening.
Good evening.
Welcome, Grant.
Thank you.
Grant, so, your book.
Indeed.
How on earth did you ever get around to writing a book after making 7 years? How did that happen?
So, I have a mentor who I meet once every 6 months. And he said to me, "Grant, when are you going to write your book?" And I said, "I'm not going to do it until Hand in Hand is a success." And he said, "Then you'll never write it, because Hand in Hand will never be a success in your eyes." And I thought, yeah, that's a good point. So in 2012, I started to write some of my stories. And 100,000 words later, that same person who said, "When are you going to write the book?" introduced me to Stephanie. Stephanie took it on in 2015, and 4 years later, we now have the book.
So you mentioned Hand in Hand, and many of you won't have read the book yet, but Hand in Hand is a key part of what you've done. It's the name of the foundation, the charity foundation, and it's the name of all your many and various businesses, successful and less successful. It's a very honest book. So tell us a bit about Hand in Hand. How did it start?
So 21 years ago, two friends of mine asked me if I would start a charity with them, and I said no. And they said, "Why not?" And I said, "Because there's plenty of good charities doing plenty of good work. Why reinvent the wheel?" And they said, "Okay, then go to the project that they wanted to support, which was actually in Brazil, and then give us your answer." So I went to this project in Brazil and met a man who could have been a very wealthy businessman, but had given his life to 300 street kids, which he had created an oasis in the middle of a slum. And I just found him so inspiring, I thought, no, I've got to respond to this. So I agreed with my two friends, Pete and Dave, and we started a charity. The following year, we visited two projects on behalf of Tear Fund in Kenya. And two of the lads on that visit said, "We would like to start our own charity and support this project in Dagoretti slum." And so I said, "Don't do that. Why don't you become part of Hand in Hand and get the benefits of tax relief, etc.?" So they became part of Hand in Hand, and that's how Hand in Hand Kenya began. And a year later, I'm sitting in a tin shed, which is a family home to a mother and three children. We were sponsoring two of their children through education. And as I sat in the tin shed, I thought to myself, do these children aspire to anything more than this tin shed? And one of the challenges in Kenya is that unemployment is so high, people at the lower end get paid very poorly. And I thought, can I create commercial employment that pays people at the lower end a bit better? And that was when I then moved into business, with both its failures and success.
And it is inspiring, because some of you are maybe here, and I'm certainly here, because I've done a few things in Africa, and we've certainly been charitable things, and some of them have made a bit of an impact. but it is incredibly frustrating that you're often working in a system where ultimately the best people can ever achieve an incredibly low because of unfair employment practices across the board.
Mm.
However, setting up business in Africa, I don't know how many of you have been to Africa, looks to me, and I've been about a dozen times, looks to me really brave, especially for a whitey.
Well, you could either say brave or foolish. I'm not sure how you distinguish between those two words. But fundamentally, I would say the key has been choosing the right business partners. And what I looked for in a business partner was somebody who was already successful in business. I wasn't looking to make somebody successful in business, but I looked for somebody who was already clearly very sharp at business, but also was very strong in their ethics. And when I found a person like that, I looked to build a relationship. And I can tell you that I built some relationships, which are not relationships anymore. And I built one relationship with a man called Peter and Jero, who I met 19 years ago. And we're 50-50 partners in most of the businesses that we do. And he's a Kenyan.
And I was also interested to find out that you were originally, after quite a number of years, a quantum surveyor, because in a previous life, I worked in the office of a quantum surveyor. So I know that they are the bean counters of the construction industry. And I would never have thought that a social entrepreneur or any kind of entrepreneur would have started off life as a quantum surveyor. But how did you get from there to here?
I can't really explain it other than I've always had ideas. My wife, who two or three of you have already said tonight, where is she, who have read the book, my wife says that when I die, she's going to write on my gravestone, Grant Smith, I've got an idea. And I've always had ideas, and I always look at things slightly differently. I can remember a particular instance when the only two direct flights 15 years ago to Kenya were Kenya Airlines and British Airways. And British Airways had a strike, and they were having several strike days that were announcing. And I said to Sue, what a cracking time to book a British Airways flight. And Sue said, but they're announcing strikes. And I said, yes, but therefore their flights will be a lot cheaper because people don't want to fly British Airways. And that is not something that I particularly sat down and thought, how can I be different? It was just my natural thinking. And that's just the way God made it. I can't take any credit for it. It's just how it is.
Do you take credit for the failures, though? Or do you own them? Because you do list quite a number of things that failed. And that's quite a hard thing. You must have lost money. Did you lose other people's money? Did you lose reputation in that process?
So, fortunately, we only lost our own money. So in the early days, I was working part-time as a quantity surveyor and part-time developing the business in Kenya. And so we were using our own money to invest in the business. And it was only that money that we actually lost. I'm glad to say, by the grace of God, that all investors that have put money into us have not lost their money. And that's a miracle in itself. I do think there is a challenge here, is that some people don't know how to ask for money, and I've never had a problem asking for money, and some people don't feel comfortable using other people's money in risky ventures. But my attitude is that I don't hide anything from you. If you see the benefit or the impact, and you want to come on board with that risk, then brilliant, I'll use your money. If you want to put your money in the bank at 2.5%, then really you shouldn't be looking at me.
No, I think that's a fair piece of financial advice right there. So tell me, at the moment, when you look at the different things that you've done, what's the thing you're most proud of? The thing that's had the impact that you think, I don't know, the thing you have a soft spot for?
So going back to that tin shed where the burden, the vision, the desire was to create employment, which was paying a little bit better, and that was it. It wasn't, I'm not even going to go as far as to say fair employment, because I think your definition of fair employment and a Kenyan's definition of fair employment would be quite different. So my concept was just to create fairer employment than they were getting. And what that basically means is that the business owner takes less. If you're going to achieve that, the business owner has to take less. It's got to give from somewhere. Or you make your business more efficient. And I'm a director of a construction company, a Kenyan construction company, and we pay all our crafts men and women by what they do, not on the day rate. So what that means is a hard-working person can earn double or treble the day rate. That seems to me a little bit fairer pay. A lazy person will earn nothing, and I'm sorry, I can't help that person. We create a structure that enables people to earn more. So one of my most, what would I see as my greatest achievement? I think it is that ability to have a structure that has been able to give people an opportunity to earn more money, which means that they can pay their own school fees instead of looking for a donor to sponsor, so that they can actually put their school, their child through education, through their own dignity, rather than coming to World Vision or Hand in Hand Charity and saying, will you sponsor this child for $30 a month for 14 years? And at the end of 14 years, you get nothing back. That's charity, we understand that. But by facilitating and equipping a person to earn the money to be able to pay the school fees themselves, they go home with the dignity that I've trained my own child. And they don't even give the credit to me, because I didn't do anything in one sense. I simply created the platform to allow it to happen.
And do you live in Kenya?
No, I don't. I live about probably a third in Kenya, two-thirds here.
And at the moment, just sitting here right now, what are some of the biggest challenges you're facing?
Money. If we had more investment, then we would be able to do more. Mm-hmm. There's a story in the book where there are so many charities and Christian missions that have land in prime land in Kenya that was either given to them or they paid very little money for, and today is literally worth millions. As the economy has grown, as Nairobi has grown, so there's an example in the book of CMS Africa where we built a 16-story building. We employed 150 people for 18 months, all being paid better. We created 16 apprenticeships. But the accidental bit, which is partly why the book's called The Accidental Social Entrepreneur, is that the equity share that the landowner owns is now generating $300,000 a year in rental income. That's $300,000 dependable, inflation-proof income that they can plan into the future of their programs, rather than being on the good wishes of donors who might say, I think you should invest in growing trees, mm-hmm. when they don't want to grow trees. Mm-hmm. But because the donor says, I'll invest in trees, they grow trees. Mm-hmm. This is their money, indigenous Kenyan money, that they are now have consistent access to plan their programs. That wasn't the challenge, was it? The challenge is, I've got 60 of those projects on my desk.
And how much your money for how many of them?
I guess if you said the average project was about £10 million. So if somebody would like to invest £600 million tonight,
then
we'd be all good. That'd be fine. And tonight's visit would have been well worthwhile.
So I'm going to throw this open in just a minute. I have one last question to start incubating your own questions, and we'll have plenty of time. But doing all that is fantastic. Writing a book takes a good amount of time. So what made you take time out of all that social entrepreneurism to write a book? Why the book?
Because I think there is a challenge that we look at problems. They could be in Edinburgh. They could be in Britain, they could be in Europe, they could be around the world. But we are all aware of different problems we've become sensitive to. And we think they're too big for us to do anything about. And the reason for writing the book is because I believe you're wrong. And the reason I believe you're wrong is because I'm right. And fundamentally, I never believed that we could have had the level of impact that we are growing into. When I first sat in that tin shed, and our first business was actually, if I remember correctly, was sourcing second-hand earth-moving equipment from the UK to sell in Kenya and we only actually did two tractors and a JCB. The JCB was for a ministry of organisation, which I did at cost, and the two tractors I never got paid for, other than that I do evidently own a piece of land somewhere in the Rift Valley towards Uganda, which I've never seen. But my point is that if you don't start and try, then it won't grow. An oil tanker, to start it moving, takes a lot of diesel, a lot of engine power, etc. Once it's going, it's very easy to steer it into a new direction. And I so believe that every one of us in this room is special and is good at different things. Whatever it is you're good at, you shouldn't be looking at me and saying, I wish I was a quantity surveyor. I'm sure you're not.
No.
But you should be looking at who you are and why you are who you are and how God can use who you are for things that are far bigger than you ever imagined or dreamed of.
Would you treat us, please, to just a little bit of a reading in the Blackwell's tradition?
Okay. I've forgotten now what I said I was going to. So this piece is chapter one, which I only just realised today isn't the first chapter. I realised there's a chapter before chapter one, which is quite clever. Why I actually decided to look at business after I'd been challenged in that tin shed, what added to the story? Because in our lives, I think there are pivotal events, but then God builds on those pivotal events to move them into something that perhaps is realistic and actually doable. I'm just trying to find the bit which I'd like to read to you. So, as I say, we're all equal and we're all very special to God. I was in a moderate hotel on the beach in Kenya. I was staying in a moderately priced hotel in Africa, beach resort, enjoying a quiet drink by the pool with Sue. You could hear the gentle lapping of the waves and very little else. And suddenly the peace was shattered by a gentleman from another part of the world, supposedly talking to his family, but addressing everybody within a half a mile radius. We will have a party, and it will be one hell of a party, and anybody who is somebody will be there. As much as I didn't want to listen to this character, it was unavoidable. And I kept thinking to myself, but I bet the pool attendant won't be there, and he's somebody. And I bet the waiter won't be there, and he's somebody. In fact, I doubt I'll be there. And I know that I am somebody. So are we all somebody? Somebody who at our core just wants to be loved. And when we don't get love, we have to demand it in other ways. Let us turn our attention to why some African women have a large number of children, causing us in the West to say, well, if she can't feed them all, she shouldn't have them. Let me introduce a poor African man. Let's say he's a carpenter, and let's call him Darren. Darren comes along and meets a poor African girl. Let's call her Joy. Darren meets Joy. Darren tells Joy he loves her. One thing leads to another, and Joy becomes pregnant. On hearing that Joy is pregnant, Darren disappears because he either can't afford or doesn't want to afford the cost of bringing up a child. And so Darren's a pinhead. But what about Joy? Why didn't she protect herself? Perhaps it's because some women gain their significance from having children. Why might she think like that? Well, Joy is one of 15 other children. Or Joy wasn't sent to school, and so can't gain a sense of significance through education. Joy has no self-esteem, and there are probably at least 10 more reasons which I'm unaware of. And Joy now has one, maybe two, perhaps three children. And each time it's because a man has told her that he loves her. And each time she prays that it is true. And each time he legs it once he got what he wanted and is faced with the responsibility. So what does Joy have to do to survive? And one of her options is to sell sex, because she knows there's plenty of demand for this. For a few quid a go, Joy can make some money to feed her the family that Darren or John or Rory should be helping to finance. And we criticise Joy and take the moral high ground, horrified that a young mother with young children is selling sex behind the curtain, separating from her children in order to feed those children. And then Joy gets HIV, and we feel some pity but we also demand, why didn't you protect yourself? But when it comes to a choice between a loaf of bread or a piece of rubber, and it's a case of either or, what would you choose? So instead we ask Joy, why did you take the risk? And Joy says, if I don't sell sex, I have no money and I'll definitely starve to death. If I do sell sex, I may become HIV positive, I may get AIDS, and I may die. The odds are better selling sex than not. So, you have a poor man who wants sex but can't afford it. You have a poor woman who desperately wants love and significance and is prepared to take a risk. You have a young mother with no way of feeding her children. You have a prostitute. You have an AIDS victim. You have three orphan children. You have a grandmother left with the responsibility of bringing up three children. You have three children whose grandmother can't afford their education. And you have three prostitutes in the making. If you could change one thing, what would it be? Possibly it's to ensure that Darren gets paid properly for being a carpenter and ensure that Joy also has work that pays properly. You asked if my faith is still as strong today. The verse that has been my principle throughout is Matthew 25:40. Whatever you did for the least of these, you did for me. Have we understood what it is to be a disciple? Have we understood what Jesus did on the cross for me? Have we understood the responsibility that we have? That whatever we do for anyone, we do for Jesus. That's what drives my life. That's what drives me out of bed in the morning. I could have a much easier life just going and being, what was it, a bean counter. Thank you. Maybe it's the reaction to being a bean counter that God inspired me to go and do these things.
Thank you so much, Grant. That was absolutely brilliant. Very, very interesting. So, lovely thing with a crowd of this size, you now have 25 minutes. You can buy one copy of the book for $12.99. But the smart money goes on buying two or multiples of two, because two copies is £20. Thank you enormously to Blackwells for hosting this event. I don't know who's representing Blackwells, but whoever you are, thank you. Well done. Thank you very much. And I don't think there's anything else I meant to
say.
Oh, yes. And then, of course, when you've bought your 1, 2, 4, 6, 8 pack of caffeines too, you can bring them to Grant and he will sign them. And we've got 25 minutes for the bookshop doesn't close till 8 o'clock. Thank you so much for coming, and thank you.
And if I may say one more thing, is that all my royalties go to Hand in Hand charity. So please buy as many as you can.
Yeah, the profits from this book are not going to grow. Yeah. You're not going to become rich yourself, are you?
I don't think God can trust me with money.
All right. Yes. Back as well, and they'll be happy, and people can come and talk to you one to one, can't they?
Yeah, that's brilliant.